Hello and welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast interested in all things related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and as always, I'm here with my good friend, Josh Steenpun.
Hello there, Adam.
It has been a while.
It has. Yeah, considering, well, we did say in the introduction we're going to leave time for comments and any feedback, ideas for the episode. So we did that.
And the deluge of feedback will all be incorporated.
That's it, exactly. But excited to continue on with this topic. Maybe yes. We should remind our listeners what that topic is, the new arc, I guess.
Yeah. So in today's episode, we continue the money, money, money arc that we introduced last time. And to recap, regular listeners may be aware that since we began the show like 3 years ago now, both Josh and I have transitioned to new day jobs. Josh is now a tenure track professor at York University, and I have made the jump from research into research administration. And these positions have provided new perspectives on how academic research is financed, at least in Canada. So we thought sharing what we've learned would be very relevant to the show, even if it's not strictly paleolimnological in nature.
Yep, that's right. And we talked about a few different topics we will explore in that series arc, and maybe some more will come up as we go. But the idea bit that being that for most of our listeners, which we again assume are graduate students, when most grad students, and this includes us, begin that journey, enter into a new lab, office, whatever it is for the first time, they're going to go into that after applying to grad school, coming out of an undergrad, perhaps taking some time off. And when they do that, they're joining into an environment that's relatively put together, fully equipped in some form. It may be a new lab, it may be an older lab, but it will be established in some perspective. And they're not going to be putting a lot of effort into that process. They'll be maybe doing field work, and, you know, have to go through the receipt process and the reimbursement process, which is a pain in the butt to do. But really how the money sort of comes in and goes out, moves around, basically the finance of that sort of environment is a little bit abstract or removed and not really part of the day-to-day thinking of graduate students.
Yeah. And it's been quite a while now since we were grad students ourselves. But we still thought it'd make some sense to begin this arc, like to properly begin the arc, looking at scientific finances from a graduate student perspective.
For sure. Cause we do think, well, I think about this quite a bit, for our own grad students. And it's actually quite interesting to think about those comparisons, and, maybe we'll get into a little bit of that.
So the majority of research funds are acquired by the professor of the lab, and we'll definitely be talking about that.
I hope, anyway.
in detail in another episode, as we have, or one of us has some firsthand experience with that acquisition of funds. But the first exposure to research funding of any kind, really, for the vast majority of people, is as either an undergraduate or a master's student. And
yeah, are we going to talk a little bit about undergraduates in this, or are we going to focus on the graduate students? Because
it's mostly focused on the graduate students, but have you not reviewed the notes? We're going to be talking about like summer sweat positions and things like that a little bit. So good. Some stuff would be undergraduate relevant, but mostly grad student.
Yeah. And even if you're coming in and that's totally off your radar, knowing that that's an entry point into the system, definitely probably the very first potential entry point is good, because you may end up working with students of that nature. I did read the notes. Thank you very much. Anyway, let's continue.
Okay. But yes, so the trope of a starving student is a very common one in all kinds of media and pop culture kind of sense. And that is because it is real. Post-secondary education is expensive, and it's getting more expensive all the time. And it is harder and harder, if not impossible now. I don't remember the last time it would have been possible to essentially pay as you go, but it was definitely before my time, before that was really viable.
Yeah, and by pay as you go, what are you referring to? Like, what would that look like, I guess?
I guess in my brain, in that phrase I was thinking of, you know, an undergraduate student being able to make enough at a summer job to cover the upcoming year of expenses. And so that means the vast majority of students, undergraduate students for sure, you know, that's where you're either taking out loans, you're drawing down previous savings if you're independently wealthy, or, you know, relying on parental support. Those are basically the three options.
Of-
in addition to having some sort of income in the summers and even while you're taking classes.
Quite a bit more common, I think, than it was. I certainly knew many people who had jobs throughout the school year, the academic year. I think, at least at York, it is absolutely I would say majority of students have some sort of employment throughout the year in their undergrads. And that makes sense. Absolutely. The ability to, you know, get enough money in those 4 months to last you through the whole year is quite a bit more challenging, if and not impossible.
Yeah. And so just to give some context, we can pull up some tuition numbers. So this is completely separate from the massive rise in recent years of the cost of living, but just tuition on its own. So these are Canadian numbers. Obviously, as always, our focus is very much on what we know. So the Canadian average for undergraduate tuition is $6,834 a year. Mm-hmm. And the average for graduate tuition is $7,437 a year. So before you do anything else, before you have a roof over your head or have anything to eat over that entire year, basically you need $7,500 off the stop, off the hop as a graduate student.
Averaged over the whole of the country, which is going to have huge discrepancy. Well, not huge, but definite discrepancies across the different provinces and institutions.
Yeah. And then I pulled up the numbers specific to Queen's, but within the Faculty of Arts and Science, because this varies both university to university and also degree to degree. And the undergraduate number is higher than the national average at $7,422.81 for an undergraduate, but then puzzlingly a bit lower than the average for a graduate student at $7,185.77.
Right, which may be related to including professional, I don't know if the Canadian one includes MBAs, whereas obviously in arts and science, there's not going to be an MBA. There's some arithmetic there that makes it a little bit harder to piece together. The point remains, that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And it is even more money if you are an international student. So this is keeping in mind that domestic students, a portion of their tuition is covered through the tax base and the funding to universities. But at Queen's, an international graduate student, their annual tuition as of 2022, I think these numbers are for, the most recent numbers, is $15,096.23 per year. So double.
Right. On top of elevated travel costs, because you have to fly, you're not going to just drive down the 401 to get to the place. Barriers to having employment while you're there, employment outside of sort of the academic environment. It may be harder to get a job, for example, if it's not impossible. So that's a huge number and a real big, real big issue.
And I'm not entirely sure how the decisions are made about what tuition is set at. Some sort of high level at the university in combination with, tuition is set on some level by the provincial government because there's a provincial tuition freeze currently in effect. But then that The levels that they were frozen at would have been set at some point by some sort of complicated funding formula. We could look into it maybe in a future episode, because if definitely there's some interesting wrinkles and, you know, things to look into in more detail in terms of how universities have funded and the growing reliance on international students, the tuition of international students over recent decades.
Yeah, I think that actually is an interesting topic to pencil in somewhere else.
Yeah, because the tuition freeze obviously only affects the tuition being charged to domestic students. The, you know, it's like if you're not a citizen of Canada, there's no protection provided in those kind of things.
For sure. And the tuition freeze is in Ontario. So, you know, if you're at UBC or certainly outside of Canada, the much different rules. But again, the fact remains, the values do change, but I've never heard of them going down. They continue to go up.
Yes.
And you know, the university gets to set what those are in consultation with these other processes. Sometimes it's at the faculty level. Sometimes it might be more broadly distributed at the university. I mean, ultimately they're approved by Senate and the board of directors and those kinds of bodies at the university, whatever they're called. And then, you know, that's the price of admission, quite literally. And there's not much you can do about that. If you want a master's degree, that's what you have to pay.
Yep. And, you know, it's just using that segue into master's degrees. Graduate school is a little bit different again, because it is full time. You do not have summers off to have a, you know, full time job for 4 months of the year to generate some of those funds, because most of the time you'll have some money coming in through some combination of scholarships, a stipend, and this varies a little bit by discipline, but TA-ships as well. Mm-hmm. And so the whole, I guess, funding dynamic is a little bit different, as opposed to spend money 8 months of the year, make money 4 months of the year. It's kind of a more homogenous, in some cases, kind of system.
Balanced, And that tuition is prorated over the whole year as well, whereas, I mean, obviously it's on an annual basis as an undergraduate, but you really are only there unless you're taking summer courses, which you tend to have to pay on top of to do. So your tuition would go higher just for those 8 months, at least in our calendar. That's an interesting point. It does, I mean, there are many, many graduate students who have jobs outside of and we'll talk about that in a minute. But a lot of the funding is sort of tied around your research, the research occurring in your lab, and or facilitating other aspects of the university curriculum as a TA or a grader or those kinds of different relationships. So it is a little bit more kind of nuclear around the university.
Yeah. So I guess maybe kind of delve into those three income sources, I guess. So scholarships, stipends, and TA-ships. So scholarships are highly variable. So in some cases, we'll be talking about things like entrance scholarships that you'll get just at the application level. Well, I think this has changed a fair bit with grade inflation. Like, I don't know how this works anymore. It used to be like there'd be some sort of cutoff at I don't know, in the 90s as an applicant, and then you'd get some sort of level of your tuition covered. I wouldn't know. I'd never got one of these. I was not one of those students, but apparently you did.
I did, yes. Turned down a couple in other places that were even more lucrative. But I had good high school grades. And I think my... it wasn't a full ride. I had 2 years, which was, I think it was called the Queen's Principal Scholarship or something like that. And it was like 8,000 Canadian at the time. So tuition and a little bit of what went to housing costs. But that was huge. Like that I wouldn't say it made my decision to go to Queen's, but if I hadn't had that and I did have options at other places, I would have taken the scholarship at other places. So like not having that at Queen's would have been, changed my path quite a bit.
Okay. So then you have scholarships. And then I I had, through graduate school, what's called the Ontario Graduate Scholarship, and where this was a separate one, so I don't even remember how you actually applied.
It was changed anyway, so it wouldn't
that
matter.
That doesn't matter. But anyway, so some portion of graduate students would receive one of these, but there was no actual direct funds to the student, to me at the time, but it basically replaced the TA-ship. And so it made up the minimum stipend for me by reducing the number of TA-ships I would have to take, and then allowed me to TA for extra money is the way that it actually worked. So you basically could choose between doing the full allotment of TA-ships and having more money in your pocket, or have more time to work and still receive the minimum stipend. And at the time, I opted for the money.
Yeah. And I think that probably always has differed and does differ depending on the units, the graduate program's specific requirements. So at York, in our grad program, that's not how it works. You have a minimum TA load that is guaranteed depending on other bigger scholarship kind of things. And then OGS, Ontario Graduate Scholarship, basically becomes summer stipend for you.
Okay.
It is effectively how it works. So it would replace. And many people get paid sort of off of research grants in the summer. And again, it totally depends on the unit. Biology just in the building across the way would be totally different how they handle it. And the only other thing I when I was talking about undergraduate entrance scholarships, graduate programs have entrance scholarships as well. So in our program, a few students a year will be granted extra money. And that is truly extra, like income in that case. And those can be used for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes they're used to attract the sort of top candidates who maybe have a couple of different options for graduate school. So it is something to keep an eye out for in certain programs. And locations, just to add that, forgot that part. Yeah, so it's a complicated menagerie of stuff as you kind of start to wade through these, even in one province, in one graduate system kind of thing. You know, the paleolimnologists, assumably no one else is listening to this, but people who are kind of in that science, geography, biology, geology environment, it can be quite complicated. And you really, I think if there's anything, you know, you can stop listening after this, is to really learn these details. Like when you're applying for graduate school, have a look, talk to other, you know, get information from, contact information for someone currently in the program, and ask these kind of questions about what the funding package makeup looks like, how you get these things, what happens if you get OGS. Do you get that as extra cash, or do you just get it clawed back? Can you then pick up those kind of questions? Like, someone will be able to answer those questions. And if you have no idea going in, you know, you could either be doing a lot of extra work for not much gain, or kind of losing out on potential extras.
Yeah. And I think that's a piece of advice that you'll run into again and again, is like, contact people beforehand. And just get a sense on so many different aspects. And, you know, I didn't do much of that. I kind of flew in blind.
Nope.
And, you know, it's one of those things of hindsight is 2020, like the world is even more connected now than it was, but I think, I'm quite happy with the route that I took. So I don't think much would change, but I think, yeah, a couple of key emails while I was applying would have just smoothed out some of the bumps, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Just take away any surprises.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
All right. So we did scholarships, stipends. I guess the first thing we need to do is define what exactly is a stipend, because it's not a commonly used word.
It's not. It's a strange word. What do we have as the textbook, let's call it Wikipedia, definition of a stipend?
It is a regular fixed sum of money paid for services or to defray expenses. It is often distinct from an income or a salary because it does not necessarily represent payment for work performed. Instead, it represents a payment that enables somebody to be exempt partly or wholly from waged or salaried employment in order to undertake a role that is normally unpaid or voluntary.
Right, or defrays those requirements and takes away the need to that. So if you, as an example, you know, if we're talking about the graduate student stipend, if you just took the number of hours you work and the only thing you tend to get paid hourly for is TAing, generally RA ships, research assistant ships, some way, you don't make enough to be above the poverty line, like for the number of hours you have. So you get this stipend, which is a payment. It might be metered out over different numbers of payments to make up that difference. And in that case, it's not salary. It's not income in the same sense. Often, at least in the Canadian taxing system, it's not taxed in the same way as income when it comes down to tax time. But that makes a part of the take home money if it's not even if it's not salary.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so it's, I guess, yeah, so something that wouldn't fall under the kind of legislation that would cover things like minimum wage, because no one is going to be covering how many hours of work. Is just, you will get this monthly statement to keep yourself fed and clothed and sheltered while you do this degree to minimize the number of students living out of cars and such as
what it would have set up. Or living in the lab.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they depend huge, like unit to unit within a school, school to school, definitely. Even what they call it. So I don't think we call ours a stipend. I'm not even sure what we call it, but it is a stipend in that sense.
Yeah.
By that definition, ultimately it's a set amount of money that comes from some source. Sometimes it's from the faculty, sometimes like the individual supervisor, sometimes it's from the program sort of at the university level that sort of sets this minimum value that sort of is then added on to by salaried teaching, extra work as a research assistant, which is usually salaried or something like it. You know, you work a number of hours over a time period.
Yeah.
Often through grants.
Yeah, and this, and then getting back, we'll come back to this another time. But this money in large part is going to be generated by the professor through grant applications. And so that was two of the three, and then the third would be TA ships. And both Josh and I come from science backgrounds, where TA ships are a common contributor to the minimum stipend. And this is just, you know, in science, there's lots of laboratory courses, with lots of individual, like repeated sections of the laboratory courses, means you need a fair number of TAs. And that's just the way it is. If you're doing like a particular chemistry lab or a particular limnology lab, your actual lecture class is going to be broken up into 4, 5, 6 in big universities, many more than that. Sections, and they're all going to run through the labs, and all of those sections are going to need a TA to kind of demo things. And so because of that, in science, there always seems to be a shortage. There are usually more TA, or at least when I was a graduate student, more TA ships available than grad students to do them. So you could always have the option to pick up some of the least desirable courses if you really wanted to. To top up top up your stipend, basically.
Yeah, and I think that probably depends, again, depending on location. Big grad programs that maybe have that dominate a unit, like a faculty or department, whatever it is, that doesn't have a lot of undergraduate courses may not be the case. Yep. So like in an example, our Masters of Environmental Studies students, this is a course-based master, so quite a bit different, are not guaranteed TA ships. Some of them will pick them up where they have background that overlaps with courses, but there's a lot of MES students in the program. And many of the undergraduate courses and programs are fairly small in terms of number of students, are very hands-on with the faculty. So you end up with less need for TAs. But in science, I think that's a pretty accurate statement.
My undergraduate at Waterloo, and at that time, I was able in my fourth year to pick up a TA ship. An undergraduate, and in my fourth year, I TA'd a second year course twice, I think.
Yeah, at Queen's in biology, it didn't occur, but in other units in geology, the fourth year is regularly TA'd.
Yeah, So highly, highly variable. And TA ships generally tend to be a little weird in that the sense that they officially have a very high pay rate in terms of dollars per hour. I can't think of exactly what it is now, but it, you know, is on paper is always much better than a minimum wage job. But usually there is a low number of hours, and especially the first couple times you do this, you may not be aware that there's a bit of a time trap, as in there's a set number of hours associated with each TA ship you're assigned. And if you're not careful, you can definitely put in considerably more time in terms of the preparation, the marking, the interactions with students, depending on how available you make yourself.
Email. Your email is where the problem will be.
Was that a thing really when you were a grad student? So now we're going back to 2000. Email was very prevalent. But when I was a grad student, the students would always come and talk to at the office hours, like emailing your TA. And I can't think if I ever emailed my TA even once throughout my undergraduate. Like, it just wasn't a thing. But I guess it's just a cultural change, and especially a post-pandemic cultural change.
Yeah, so our grad students get 135 hours per course is the number. And we do workload agreements, you know, that lay out what that should look like. And I don't ask to see it, but I do recommend that they track, you know, kind of like if you were to go into consulting, you know, do, you know, track 15-minute blocks of their time, because it's if for no other reason than to realize how much time you can put into something. Preparation, making a slide deck that you're going to use yourself, or things like answering emails and grading is obviously the biggest one. It is pretty sobering to see how quickly 135 hours of your life can evaporate, and you have, you know, you haven't even started marking the final paper, and you basically then you're cutting into your own profits. You don't get paid any extra. I mean, there is the potential for the provision of overtime, but very rarely is that approved.
Yeah, so. I definitely, especially in the early days, just ended up running over. I remember setting out like whole Sunday afternoons, but then at the same time, I wouldn't be hyper focused. I'd be like, I am going to get this stack of whatever's marked. And I'm just set up at a kitchen table and the TV is on and there's a football game or a soccer game going on in the background. And it'd be just a leisurely kind of rate as opposed to get this done in the minimum amount of time. So it really depends on how you approach it.
For sure. So that's it. That's kind of what generally makes up the pay packet of a graduate student in different proportions. External scholarships, internal scholarships and stipends, teaching assistantships, and then the potential for research assistantship sort of work paid by the faculty, and every unit will have a different balance of what that looks like. And then, so you, basically the idea is you have that value, that total amount, and the tuition, and the difference between them is what you have to live on for a whole year,
yeah,
two whole years if you're doing a master's, four plus years for a PhD. And that, you know, that doesn't leave a lot. If you to do the minimum stipend value at a university, whatever that is, even a, you know, a relatively well-funded one, I think York's, our graduate one is 24,000, something like that for domestic students. And it is higher for international students because of that huge difference. So 24,000,
subtract
7,000, 7,500 away from that, you know, that's not much.
And this has changed drastically from about, you know, I began my graduate student path about 20 years ago now. And I racked up, you know, I was able to get through undergraduate through student loans, but through graduate school, I was largely in a treading water kind of position. I lived lean, but, you know, the loans were on whatever OSAP calls their interest-free status. They were just kind of doing their thing. And then I continued to just tread water rather than grow debt, have a growing debt. And that on 25,000 is just not possible anymore.
No.
Because the stipends have not changed.
No, exactly. The tuition keeps going up a little bit. Probably pretty close to sort of the inflation level. Stipends haven't changed at all. We can talk about this in a second. And the cost of living, everything else has gone up like, you know, significantly in that time period. And even in Kingston, you know, where I think it's relatively inexpensive compared to some other locations. Like to rent, at least as an undergrad, like it seems like rent and stuff like that was a relatively small proportion of it compared to, you know, that's not the case there. It's not the case anywhere anymore. There are no cheap markets in the world. There are some exceptionally expensive markets, but nowhere is cheap, really. You know, that changes your sort of whole calculus on how you go through your graduate program. Do you want to finish as quickly as you possibly can at just barely, well, not even treading water, but probably accruing some sort of debt? Do you want to stretch it out and have to work through that time period, not be able to put as many, there's only so many hours in a week, and not be able to put so much towards your degree, but be able to eat, you know? That's something that I never thought about.
No, I am. Looking back to some, both my master's and my PhD, I ran over by a couple of months, and it was not the, you know, after 2 years running over by a month and a half, I think I like was fully done. Yeah. Like 6 weeks after I was officially hit the two month mark. And then I think it was probably something similar like 2 or 3 months by the time I defended. And so the whole process of like, I remember John coming into the office go, you need to get rolling on writing and, you know, yes, you've got a paper or two out and sorting out a an external and things like that, an external examiner for your PhD defense. And so it was like, you know, and then you do the realize, I'm not going to be able to do this by the end of the summer or whatever it is, because schedules realize, like, it's going to go over by a couple months and it's not the end of the world. It wasn't the end of the world at the time, that in a way that it'd probably be a lot more pressing now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It was possible to absorb that for some people, not everyone, obviously.
Yeah. And that, but there was even then the balance of finishing quickly versus picking up extra TA ships to fund running over. And I definitely did that where I'm like, stick around for another semester, and then I will pick up a couple of the less desirable TA ships that probably have a greater time commitment than some of the other ones. And then you go, when all is said and done, you're going, you know what? I probably could have been done in just a couple of extra hardcore weeks rather than sticking around for a couple of months. But this TA ships, or this full loaded TA ships, was just such a time suck at the end that it dragged it all, and it probably wasn't worth it in the end, and it probably is definitely not worth it now. It,
yeah, for sure. Yeah, one TA ship is not worth the tuition, basically. It's you know, the calculus is fairly straightforward there. Finish and go on and try and find employment, especially in what is, I mean, it's not easy to get a job, but it is a bit of a buyer's market. For jobs.
I guess that would be the flip side of it all. That the job market if you wanted a silver lining or whatever, the kind of view of it all is, it's much more expensive to be a student today, but the job market I think is better now than it was in, let's say, someone finishing their PhD in 2008-ish.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I think that's played out in the statistics. It is something you all have to, you definitely have to think about. And something we think about too is like programs, faculty, recruiting grad students for both of those reasons, because it's actually fairly straightforward to, you know, not straightforward, but there are jobs out there, and there weren't in 2008. But also because it's so expensive to live in Toronto, and there are other markets where that's exactly the same.
Yeah. No, I definitely, in my new role, have definitely been on a fair number of meetings. I would never have realized this as a student or in my research career, but just where see a cross section of the university department to department to department, and then see how different the situation can be in terms of the differing job markets for students in that particular field. And so there's definitely some fields out there where recruiting grad students is absolutely brutal because the job market is so hot. And it's like, I can either go into debt and starve as a student and get the same stipend as everybody else, or definitely walk into a job today and make six figures.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that is the choice.
Some of those careers, that's not, you know, like in engineering, master's degree doesn't, you know, is not all that commonly, certainly PhDs, like very rare. Don't really get you any better outcome in that job market.
Because you're doing it because you out of interest as opposed to a... The accreditation is like a step, a career step.
Yeah, exactly. You want to be a professor. And this is something that, you know, what is the solution to this? Well, giving more money would certainly help. If our, you know, stipends were higher, particularly at some of the like competitive award phases in Canada, this is something that I don't remember when those protests that were going on, it was a couple of months now, where there was light being brought to the fact that the Tri-Council Awards, so those are the NSERC, CIHR, and SHRC, Tri-Council funding agencies, the main bodies that fund research in engineering and natural sciences, health, and in the social sciences and humanities, that the values for the major scholarships, the graduate level scholarships, postdoctoral fellowships, hadn't changed in 20 some odd years, given all the inflation that's occurred between those time periods, is insane.
Yeah. And I think we pulled up a CPI, so Canadian Price Index inflation calculator, and just, you know, so I don't know why do we have 13,000 in here? But $13,000 in 2009, so 14 years ago, so something that costs $13,000. Let's say it's graduate student international tuition of something around $13,000, or an award worth $13,000. To be at parity, it would need to be $18,400 today. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of these awards, that is not the case. They're still $13,000.
No, like a $21,000 for the NSERC graduate, the PGS level, postgraduate scholarship levels. That's the same as it was. It hasn't gone up by any number.
No.
Right? So it's effectively gone down by a lot, right? In the math of it. And these are supposed to be, you know, they're limited in number. You have to apply to these awards, and they're very competitive. What is the you know, what are we trying to attract in terms of the excellence of our graduate students? What is the quality of the next level of research? It certainly doesn't show a great interest in investing in the future of science and all the other disciplines of research in this country, including things that are really important, like health research and all those things. And it's not that the private sector is going to drive all of those things. And most of those people have PhDs. They had to go to grad school anyway. So what do you do? That's a good place to start for sure.
Yeah, but that'd be a good place to start. But I don't know if those protests, you know, I don't think that start is happening yet.
No.
Like, and I see things like the budgets are not changing in some of the big tri-agency awards, and the option to increase the value of individual grants. This isn't really affecting graduate students as much as affecting professors, but it's like more reduce the success rate rather than increase the pot.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah.
And it'll be the same kind of, it would end up being the same sort of math probably. So it really does require a significant investment of new funds into research in all aspects. Yeah, it is what it is. Got to keep pushing.
Yeah. And I guess one other thing that kind of factors into all of this is that, I guess, not learning to live lean, but being okay with living lean. I don't know if it's a skill, but it would be something you grow accustomed to. And it makes a bit of a, becomes quite difficult in some cases to take a decent paying job and then go back to grad school. It's once you have gone a couple steps up, it's difficult to go back to craft dinners on a regular basis.
I would imagine so. You did that. I mean, maybe you didn't go to like six-figure salaries.
I did not.
Wearing three-piece suits every day. But I never took off. I took off like 1 month, I think.
You went plaster? No, I took short breaks in between both. Both my undergraduate degree and then again after my master's degree before starting my PhD, and had jobs at both, and definitely enjoyed the fact, like after I finished my master's, I went on like a backpacking trip to South America. It's like, I've got money, I can spend money and do some of these things that I've always wanted to do. I can take a real holiday. Then a year later going, I'm even poorer than I was as an undergraduate student. This sucks. It can be a tough pill to swallow. And it's not that I'm saying don't do it, but it's just something to keep in mind before you get too used to the feel of silk sheets, I guess. All right, I'm just going to kind of wrap the final segment up here, thinking that an important aspect of this at every level is that no one really teaches you any of this directly. And in addition to like the key funding that you'll get through the program that you're enrolled in or the university that you go to, as a student, there are often many other pots of money that are available to you in a variety of sources that you, if you go digging for them. So very specific scholarships, for example.
Yeah. We know a few people, won't name any names, who were really good at doing this sort of thing, finding small, often underutilized, underapplied to foundations and awards broadly that made up. And often those can just get added on and on and on. They don't come out of your, you know, they're not clawed back from your minimum stipend, and did pretty well with doing that. One thing I would say, if that's something you're interested in doing, really can be quite lucrative, but you have to weigh how much time it takes to apply to 50 little awards versus the time it's taking away from your actual research. So if your evenings, if the thing you love to do is write little scholarship applications, great stuff. You might do really well with that. But make sure you keep it into the perspective of the big picture.
Yeah. But depending on the value of them, like, I mean, if it's a couple hours to fill out an application through like your parents' workplace, if their union offers it,
for sure,
there's probably not a huge level of competition because, again, you're dealing with a, you know, there'll be some set number of awards and it's easy to be lazy.
The application window opens on July 1st and the first 3,700 who come, come in, get it.
Yeah. And so in some cases, these can be a very high reward to effort ratio in terms of, you spend a couple of hours on a Sunday afternoon putting your application together in, and that could be, you know, equivalent to a full TA-ship in some cases that you do over 4 months. So it really depends, but I think it's a case of looking for them both within your field and various workplace things. You know, and there's certain elements like, I think I mentioned if your family member is a member of a union, in some cases they will have dedicated post-secondary scholarships available for the children of union members. There are some, I'm pretty sure, like there are elements within some workplaces, like if you're Tim Hortons, I think has some level of internal scholarships that you could apply. So if you did that in your run-up as a student, you know, as a high school student, and then there might be some doors that are available to you specifically based on where you worked during the summers and the run-up kind of thing. And then there's also individual applications and foundations tied to your field of study. So within paleo and environmental studies, we've known students that have both gotten scholarships through the Weston Foundation and for when the related to Northern research and also through L'Oreal. Was that Northern as well? Mm-hmm. Or is that...
I think those are broader. I think it's women in science. Is sort of the catch there. But yeah, they tend to be not-for-profits or corporations. And those can be quite lucrative because they often are coming direct. They're not clawed back because they're not considered in the same way. And they can be quite big money. I had a Weston postdoc fellowship, which was great.
How did you find out about it? Was it put on your desk by somebody in particular?
It was well known. Okay. Yeah, by that time period. Okay. The Weston one has become so big that it's like applying to the NSERC program for people in that area. Others are less well known, but that one's gotten quite well known. Everyone knows somebody who has gotten one at that point.
And then there are also society-specific scholarships that you could apply to. In many cases, there'll be travel funds associated with conferences. For example, ESCAS has the...
Yep. Clemens Wigler Travel Fund and the Early Career Award.
Yep.
SIL has, the Society of International Limnology has those. They are... primarily earmarked for people from developing countries, but there are a range of different programs as well. And so, yeah, they can be really big. So the SIL ones will basically fund travel to the meeting for a small number of individuals, but that you may never otherwise be able to attend.
Yeah. And then the last thing, and then this isn't really relevant to your studies per se in what I'm thinking of, but in some cases there are specific pots of money for student initiatives at the school. And so this would be really money in your pocket per se, but there, the example I'm thinking of here is years and years ago due to the fact that all the vending machines at Queen's right. were limited to Coke products. There was actually a Coke fund for student initiatives, and we had people within our lab group apply to that to offset the costs of putting together a student conference. And so it's slightly different, but I just, you know, there are very specific pots of money out there that take some digging to unearth, but might be highly relevant to you.
Definitely. Look for them. They often are not well advertised. And I think we saw that in the newspaper. Like there was a ad in the newspaper, which I guess is well advertised, but no one read any of those things.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I think they paid a fair bit towards that conference.
I think so. I think it was one of those things where
thanks Coca-Cola.
Yeah, like a lot of us have like registration of like $20 or $30 or something like that, even though there were multiple meals and whatnot associated with it. But so yeah, so it went a long way.
You can get some things done. Yeah.
Once again, thanks for listening to Core Ideas, the Paleolimnology podcast. If you have a question or a comment, or perhaps a suggestion for a future show, please send us a note.
Our email address is coreideaspodcast@gmail.com, and our Twitter X, what do we call it? I don't know. I've stopped using it. Handle is @coreideaspaleo. We'll probably be even worse at replying to that than we were before. However, something new, folks. Our Mastodon handle is @coreideaspaleo. So the same beginning, @mastodon.social. So find us there. I don't know if you follow. I'm not sure how this
works exactly,
but you'll see our toots there and it'll be great.
It works exactly the same in terms of at least the level that we use it in terms of advertising the release of individual shows and some direct messages. And an archive of our past episodes and show notes is maintained on our website. the address, the easiest way to find the address, it's coreideas.ajazierski.ca, but we have direct links to it on both our Mastodon page and our Twitter page.
And if you're so inclined, you can give us a rating, subscribe, leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Those 5-star ratings and reviews are great, but to be honest, we don't really care all that much. We're still just doing this for fun.
And that's it for today. But we'll be back soon to explore how money fuels academic research in more detail, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy, even when talking about the economy of knowledge.